Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista. This is Jim Dowling, host of Right Stuff. And we are doing part two of an interview with Michael Schlosser, who's written a book about Vietnam called Stalag Vietnam. We realized that when we did the first interview, there were a lot of things we didn't get to. So we've decided it's worth another installment. Thanks for being here, Mike. Really appreciate it. This segment, we're going to talk a little bit more what it was actually like fighting over there, what the conditions were, what you had to put up with.
Life in the prison.
Life in the prison. The first segment, if you didn't hear it, we focused more on the draft and the conditions in the United States, how people felt about the war, things like that. But today we're going to get down and dirty in the swamps.
That's good.
Why don't you kick it off there, Mike, with any place you want to start on that?
We finished it. The first session, I read about the transition from flying in the airplane across the ocean and then landing in Vietnam. So continuing along, we had a few, almost a week there where we got acclimated. They gave us some time to try and acclimate to the horrendous weather. And then you were assigned to the units. And I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne, which I was never trained to jump out of an airplane, but they needed bodies. So the only thing we jumped out of was helicopters. So I spent the rest of the time over there with the 82nd Airborne, doing night ambushes in the jungle. As I mentioned in the first session, the Mekong Delta is a 15,000 square mile swamp. It's filled with all the runoff from the Mekong River. It's a sea of mud, sea of swamp. Mosquitoes, rats, leeches, bugs, just a horrendous place to live. And that's where we lived, in the swamps, for really the rest of the time I was over there.
So you trained at Fort Lewis before you went.
Mm-hmm.
Did Fort Lewis get you ready for these conditions?
The interesting about training in Fort Lewis is the last week we did in Fort Lewis, it was after Christmas. We got to go home for Christmas, and then we had to go back for two or three more weeks. The last week of training that we did in Seattle, Fort Lewis, was a week of Vietnam training out in the snow out by Mount Rainier.
In the snow.
Exactly. The first night, it was raining when we left on Sunday. That night, it turned to snow. And the rest of the week, our sleeping bags were wet. They wouldn't let us have tents because you didn't use tents in Vietnam. We didn't even use sleeping bags in Vietnam, but they gave us sleeping bags. But it was awful. We're freezing to death. I'm absolutely freezing to death. And a week later, I stepped off the airplane in Vietnam. And that's why the heat, when you stepped out of the airplane, it just sucked the breath right out of you because you're coming from snow climate last week, and now you're in the tropical jungle climate next week. It's just... It was a rude awakening when we got there.
Yeah, in so many ways.
Yeah.
And so you're there for a few weeks, and then you're out in the swamp? Is that
two
how
weeks,
it works?
Yeah, we had about weeks. 2 weeks of, you know, basically it was acclimation, just trying to get us used to not killing or not dying in the heat, because it was wicked heat. I mean, just hard. You know, I live in Reading, and we talk in the summer about how hot it is there. It is hot. But there's a difference between 100 degrees and 100 degree or 100% humidity at the same time. That's a whole different.
Sure. You know. So you fall in with a group of guys, mm-hmm. and most of them have been there longer.
Mm-hmm. They all have, yeah.
Kind of like a band of brothers. Mm-hmm. You get to know each other pretty well.
You were the new guy.
You know? You're the new guy.
Again, going back to Oliver Stone, he showed that so well in the movie Platoon. You know, the new guys were treated like, you know, you had to kind of earn the right to be part of the real guys. And so you were, in the beginning, you were kind of low man on the totem pole. I mentioned in the first session about flying over Vietnam, and one of the things that just absolutely shocked us when we flew in over the country of Vietnam was all the fires, the burning, the black smoke. Well, what we realized when we got there, when we were assigned to burning the feces, that's what was causing all the black smoke, because we used diesel fuel. They had outhouses in the firebase. They had outhouses, but there was a door in the back, half of a 55-gallon drum. And again, it shows it in the movie Platoon.
Just burn that stuff up.
Yep.
Wow.
Diesel fuel and a stick, and you went out there and burned it up until there was nothing left. And that's why there was so much smoke in here. But it scared the devil out of you when you first saw it. I
mean, yeah, you thought, they're fighting everywhere.
Yeah. You got 500,000 guys in Vietnam. I mean, it was over 500,000 guys in Vietnam in 69. You had a lot of...
So you're sent out into the swamp. What's the goal of a patrol or whatever you're doing out there?
We operated in 10-man squads mostly. There was 10 of us. And we, a lot of night ambushes, as they show in movie Platoon. And then we did day missions where they'd send us out to just scout out the area. Sometimes they'd do helicopter assaults, and we'd be put on one side of a village, and then other guys go through the village or whatever it was. But you were always doing something that was, you know, flying around. But most of a lot of night ambushes.
Okay.
And we'd have about 30 guys in a firebase. Firebase is like a little fort, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Bunkers and stuff like that. There was about 30 guys in there. So you'd have maybe 20 of them out in the field at night doing night ambushes. The other guys are in the firebase. And then you'd rotate. So some nights you're in, some nights you're out. Some nights you're out for 3 or 4 days at a time. So it just depends on what they had us doing. But
yeah, and you know, they call it a police action. Right. It was different than a typical battlefield. You had a lot of rules of engagement.
Right.
Why don't you describe some of the rules?
Most confusing one was the free fire zones. There were sections where if you saw somebody, you could freely shoot at them. There were other sections, farmers' fields and rice paddies and stuff like that, that was people out there, you couldn't shoot at them. So the enemy was very, very difficult to decide who was Viet Cong. Because the Viet Cong was just a farmer during the day and a guy mining, putting landmines and booby traps out at night and sniping at us all the time. And so that was hard.
Well, it had to be hard. Who do you trust?
No, you didn't. That was the thing. That was the one. And that's the other thing. They talk about the difference between Vietnam and World War II. And they say, okay, how come there's so much more PTSD?
PTSD.
Yeah, PTSD, I'm sorry. How come there's so much more of that in Vietnam veterans than World War II? And one of the things I've read is that in World War II, there were front lines. And if you were on the front line, you could be, you're in the battle. But then you could go back to the rear lines and there was no risk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were no rear lines in Vietnam. You could be shot any time of day at 300. That's why we were talking about the statistics from the book, is that 900 and some guys die on the first day and 1,400 die on the last day. So you were exposed to danger and risk all the time, even near the firebase. The firebase could get mortared, attacked. I mean, you could get snipers, booby traps. You never felt safe. Never felt safe. And that's it. That mental process of always being facing death or not knowing where it's coming, you develop an attitude. The only way you develop immunity to that is you just don't care. In some cases, you almost welcome death. I mean, because death would get you out of here. I mean, we had a guy, his name was Jones. He got a letter from home. One of his buddies wrote him a letter. It said his wife was fooling around at home. And so he goes to the Red Cross and wants to go home. They won't let him go home. Goes to the Army. Army wouldn't let him go home. So he took a gun and shot himself in his foot that night. I was there when he shot himself.
Jeez.
And I always wonder, there's 200 bones in your foot. And I bet he never walked again right the rest of his life.
So he just...
It's such a waste.
Shot himself in the foot to get home.
To get home.
No. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we were going out that night on a night ambush. And I said to him, it was more than that because we were carrying food. I said to him, Jones, you're packed. You ain't got no food. And he said, I'm not going. I'm not coming back. And that night, that he shot himself in the way we hauled him out of there. And that's one of the things we should talk about is one of the things that we had to do over there was the heat and obviously injuries. There were a lot of ways, I would say there's a lot of ways to get hurt or killed over there. But one of the most harrowing things was calling a chopper in at night, a medevac chopper in at night, because it's pitch dark, you're in a swamp, and you find an open area where you can guide a chopper in. So they call the medevac, chopper's coming. You can hear the chopper coming, but the chopper has no lights on. So you got to have someone on the ground that takes a strobe light, handheld strobe light, and gets in the middle of the landing zone. And as the chopper pilot comes, you turn on the strobe light and shine it at the chopper pilot. And then he turns on a big headlight that he has on the front of his helicopter, medevac chopper. And he comes in. You guide him right into where you're pretty much where you're standing. So you're standing there in the middle of a swamp at night with this light. You're like on the middle of a stage on Broadway. You got this shining light on you. And you stand there with your eyes closed just waiting for the bullets to come at you. And when that chopper, they get the guy on there and he takes off and you finally get to turn those lights off. What a relief. I mean,
sure.
Just, gee whiz, the stress of, I mean, it's just, it was like stuff like that. And the other one's the river crossings, you know. The Mekong Delta, I mentioned, it's 15,000 square miles of swamp.
Yeah.
So we traveled primarily by boat. We had small boats with 20 horse engines on them. And then we had a big landing craft like they used in World War II with the front door that dropped down, and they'd run that into the swamp, and you'd step off and up to your waist in mud. And I mean, it was just, we traveled by boat, so that's how big that swamp is or how extensive it is. But we were like 50 miles from the ocean, and yet we would get the tides every day. They're so flat and extended so far out in the ocean. So when we're moving through the swamp, the jungles, we're continually faced with rivers. And the rivers would either be flowing from the ocean in, rising, or flowing from the land going out,
sure,
falling. And so we experienced tides twice a day. Sometimes, when we're crossing the river, sometimes we had to, because I grew up on the river, I could swim really well. So what we'd do is we'd take a rope across, and we'd string a rope across, because the rivers, the tide's going out or tide's coming in, the river's flowing really fast, and a lot of the good swimmers couldn't make it across without the rope. And I would have a couple guys, we'd have air mattresses, we'd blow the air mattresses up, and then the guys that couldn't swim across the river, we would take their gear and ferry it across the river on these air mattresses and give it to them on the other side. So one day we had a lieutenant, brand new lieutenant with us, and I took his gear, and about halfway across the river, I've got his gear on my raft, my air mattress, and all of a sudden he's falling off the rope or something. I hear him back there. He's hollering for help, help, help. So I got to go back to him, so I tipped his gear off of the boat or the air mattress, go back and rescue him and get him on there and drag him across the other side. We get him out and keep him from drowning. And then we take off, and that night he sends four of us back in the middle of the night. He says, go back and get my gear. You guys lost my gear. Go back and get my gear. And he said, don't come back until you got all my gear. So four of us go back out there, diving in the swamp at night in the mud. And
oh, my gosh.
We found it. We found all his gear.
Oh, boy.
But it was, you know, you saved the guy's life, and then he'd send you back out there in the middle of the night. And it was crazy stuff because, you know, going through a swamp at night is not a good place
to
be.
Sure. Well, yeah, and you talk about these ambushes. Mm-hmm. You could be out for as long as 4 days. Mm-hmm. And there was an incident with a mine that you talked about in the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we were moving down a trail. The Vietnamese had trails through the swamps. And there's 10 of us probably, and we decided to take a break. We carried a backpack, and the American modern day backpacks, you have these big heavy waist belts on them, and the weight on the backpack is ideally carried on your waist. Well, the packs that we carried only had shoulder straps, and they had Velcro connections on both sides. So if you needed to get the pack off really quick, you'd just pull this Velcro thing, and the pack would fall off. And it was, but they were so heavy. I mean, they would cut it. There were times they'd cut off the circulation in your arms, and you'd walk down the trail cradling your rifle in your arm.
Roughly how many pounds were you carrying?
40, 50. I mean, okay. It was just 8 quarts of water, food for days, Claymore mines, ammunition. We had a few personal effects. I mean, it was just super heavy, and it carried the whole thing on your shoulders. I mean,
yes, 8 quarts of water.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And because it was so hot, and then after, then what happens after you run out of 8 quarts?
Yeah.
Then you're dipping it out of the swamp.
Out of the swamp and putting a bunch of iodine in it.
Iodine tablets.
Sure, sure.
So we were sick all. I mean, basically sick all the time because, you know, it's just we didn't eat right. It was too hot to eat. We got very little food. Those sea rations were awful.
Okay. Yeah, well, my fault. I distracted you. We're getting back to that mine incident.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So we took a break. I took the pack off, which was always a relief, and you just kind of flopped down in the grass. And I was sitting there, and I started brushing the grass out between my legs, and I hit a wire.
Mm.
Okay. Now, the Viet Cong would steal grenades from us, and they would wire the grenade to a stick, and then they'd put the stick in the ground, and a grenade has a pin on it. So it would take a wire, and they'd run a wire to the pin, and then run the wire out through the grass. So when you're walking through the grass up to your waist in the swamp, you can't see a wire. And you hit the wire and pull a pin on the grenade, and next thing you know, there you are, hurt or dead or whatever. So we're constantly looking for these wires. Well, all of a sudden, I got a wire between my legs, and I'm just, you know you're dead. It's just you know that you just wait for the explosion, because you're not sitting on the wire, didn't happen. So what we did is, this friend of mine from Haiti, the guy I mentioned, he helped me. We took a ammunition belt. We carried 200 rounds of ammunition in a 10 clips for the M16 in a belt, and we laid the belt on the wire, and he grabbed my, great risk to his own life, he grabbed my wrists and just jerked me up, and we took off running down the trail and never went off. So
wow.
We went back, and we left the ammunition belt there.
Sure.
And hopefully they found it and set the thing off. So, but the whole point is that when you sit down and you realize that you're sitting on a landmine of some sort, that's a shock to your system. Sure. You're going to die. You know you're going to die.
Yeah.
Just waiting for the explosion. You know? So,
And the grass itself must have been hard to get through. I've heard people say it could cut you, and
It was. Our biggest thing was the mud.
The mud.
Oh, the mud. You know? I walked point quite a bit, and there was one time for sure that I was trying to find a way across the river, and there's quicksand, and the more you struggle in quicksand, the deeper you go. Well, there's quick mud too, and when I got to my armpits,
ooh,
I was stuck. I ain't getting out of there. So I had to get the guys to throw me a rope, and they dragged me out of there. And then, of course, your clothes are just filthy, dirty. I mean, there was one night when we were inundated with mosquitoes. Mosquitoes in the swamps were just beyond comprehension. So one night, the mosquitoes were just fierce. And we carried a little thin, they called it a poncho liner, but it was like a little thin nylon blanket. That's all we had for warmth. And I remember that one night, you pull the blanket up, little poncho liner up over your head to keep the mosquitoes off your head.
Sure.
And you can't stand the smell of your own body.
Oh, boy.
You can't stand it. You got it. Basically, you can't breathe. Your body is so, what I call, rotten at that point. It's just filthy dirt. Yeah, your clothes are rotten off. Your boots are rotten off. I mean, it's just, I always say, if people in the United States, if we took their dogs, their pets, and cats, and put them out and made them live like we lived, there'd be public outcries. But nobody cared what was going on over there. That's why.
So you, how did you get a change of clothing? How did that work out?
Every week or two, a helicopter would show up, and they'd kick out a bunch of clothes. And we'd strip naked and throw our dirty clothes on the chopper. Because you didn't wear any shorts or anything. You just had a shirt on and a long pants on. And I think they had three sizes. And then you were always trading sizes, trying to find something that relatively fits you. But then hour later after you got your clean clothes, they were sweat and mud toes.
And your feet, your poor feet, you know, they never dry out.
Never did, no. Yeah. Boots. That's how you could tell somebody had been there a while. You just look at their boots. New guys' boots look
like boots. Yeah.
Somebody that had been there a while, their boots, we had those combat boots that had the steel plates in the bottom.
Okay.
Because they had punji sticks over there. And,
oh, yeah.
So you wanted boots that could protect the bottom of your feet. They would literally turn white. They'd get bleached out by the mud and the water. And so.
So the some people might not know what a punji stick is. A sharpened stick. They'd put things on it.
Cover manure a lot of times.
Manure. And
stick it straight up in the ground. Dig a hole. Embed the stick so the points are up. So sure. You walk along and...
Really so much as a scratch, you're going to get infected.
Yeah. And or impaled on a stick, sharpened stick like that. Bamboo's hard. So, no, they had a lot of ways to kill you.
Well, you know, war and this kind of battle for a year really changes a person. We're talking about a very stressful situation. And you want to address that a little bit, how, you saw the Vietnamese as different. And after a while, it's kind of dehumanizing, isn't it?
Very much so. The thing that we couldn't understand was that, let's say some foreign country divided the United States in half.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter which half you'd be in. You'd be fighting for the reunited.
Absolutely, yes.
But people in Vietnam, we were fighting to rename the country, and they didn't care. I mean, they didn't care. They didn't. They were just there. That's their life, and that really frustrated us. And then, of course, there was the Army of South Vietnam, which they were supposed to help, but they weren't that interested in helping. So you felt very alone. Nobody cared over there about anything, and we developed a hatred for the people. That's why we did things to them that you wouldn't even do to your pets, you know, because they weren't human to us.
Yeah.
You know, the My Lai massacre where they went into the village, and it was just the hatred. And in Platoon again, I keep referring to Platoon. That's, you look at the end of that movie when they went into that village and just hated those people, shot that woman in the head right there with her husband sitting there. I mean, it's just. That stuff is real. It's just the hatred you develop.
That's the sad part of war. Yeah. And you saw some of that.
Yeah. I think everybody saw some. I mean, it was out in the field. You know,
yeah.
Because, no, they weren't. And again, as you your mind spirals yourself down, then the whole world spirals down with you, and it just. That's why I say we were not a military force. We were vigilantes trying to stay alive. That's all we were doing. And it
up against an enemy that was very tenacious.
They weren't going to quit.
Ho
Chi Minh said, you can kill 10 of our people for every one that we kill yours, and you still won't win. He told one of the... I think he was talking to them after the Second War, who wanted the United States to help.
And right.
He said, if you don't help, we can kill 10 of yours. You can kill 10 of ours, but we'll still be two. Yeah.
And they had a long history of fighting more powerful and China and...
And the French. The French are a good example.
And the French, sure.
They got in there and they set up the big plantations, took the land for rice, rubber production. And they brought in their culture, their religion, their architecture, so they really colonized South Vietnam, and then they wanted the country back, and Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh said, no, that's our country, you can't have it back, and French tried to take it, and they did. They held it for almost 10 years, till 1955, when they were driven out, and then we started in the 60s, early 60s, sent advisors over there, and we just got sucked into that whole muddy mess over there.
Yeah.
So it was a bad deal from the beginning, from the whole, I mean, you think about the whole premise of it, it was just politics more than anything.
Well, how did we get out of that? You know, you want to talk a little bit about the troop withdrawal, when that happened, and
yeah, because I was part of that.
Okay.
Nixon was getting a lot of heat after Tet changed the attitude.
Okay, 1968, massive attack
throughout the entire country.
Throughout the entire country.
Caught America.
Totally by surprise.
Totally by surprise.
Yeah. You know?
And the only thing that saved us to a certain extent was that it was a coordinated effort on the North Vietnam, the regular soldiers from North Vietnam, and then the Viet Cong, the local guys down south. But they messed up. One group started earlier than the other group. And it allowed, and I forget which group started first, but it allowed us to reinforce or get prepared and be ready. Had they caught us all across the country by surprise, it would have been totally dead. We won, but it was a bloody battle. It's city after city after city.
Yeah.
And see, I got there January of 69, exactly a year after Tet.
Wow.
So everybody was on edge when January 30th is Tet. Okay. So January 30th comes, that first day comes, Tet. And it was like the whole country was just quiet. There was nothing going on. Everybody's sitting there. But they did it once. They weren't going to try it a second time because they knew we were ready that second time. So,
yeah, and that's when it really hit in the United States. I mean, it ramped up a lot of the protests.
Oh, yeah. The college campuses went crazy after that because that was visible proof that we weren't making any headway over
there. Yeah. And it called into question all of the news that we'd been seeing on TV and all the statistics and all that. So that was a real turning point.
It really was, because the buildup, we kept building up. I mean, the chart from first troops in 1960 to 3,500 Marines in 65, and then by 550 some thousand by 69. So that was a huge buildup.
Yeah. Really. And so in 19, when did you come home, and how did that work out?
This was Nixon was getting a lot of heat to start pulling troops out. So in about, I'm going to say, late August, or no, I'm sorry, September of 69, Nixon announces that he's going to pull out the 82nd Airborne. He's going to start pulling troops out of Vietnam. They're still drafting troops like crazy on one hand. He's going to pull out the 82nd Airborne just to appease the people in the United States that he's doing something as president. So he announces that the 82nd Airborne is being pulled out.
And you were in the 82nd.
I was in the 82nd Airborne. But the only people that got to come home were those of us that had been there before April 1st of 69. I had got there January of 69, so I had plenty of time to come in. So the guys that came into country April 1st or later, they were simply reassigned to other units. So it was, on paper, he pulled out 5,000 guys. In reality, it was a fraction of us that had enough time to go home.
And if you just happened to be on the wrong side of that date, you didn't get to go.
And you were simply reassigned to
another unit. That must have been devastating.
Yeah.
For some
guys were standing there when we found out. There was rumors all August and September, and rumor we're going to get pulled out. We're not going to get pulled out. We're going to get pulled. The army just runs on rumors. That's all it is, rumors. Finally, the rumors came true, but the truth was that there was only a few of us going home, and some of those guys that got there on afterwards, they were actually crying, physically grown men crying, because they knew how close they came to going home, and now they got, in some cases, almost a year left before they got to go home. So.
Well, hey, Mike, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. It's been fascinating. I really appreciate you coming in.
Well, I appreciate you having me here.
Sure.
One of the things I've always said is we always felt over there nobody cared, so it's nice to have somebody care.
Oh, yeah. Well, the book is called Stalag Vietnam. It's available on Amazon. It's a great read. You want to know what it was like to get drafted and go to Vietnam? It sure measures up to all of my memories of the angst and all that. So, it's a great book. did
Thank you.
A wonderful Thank job. You. And I it might be a play, right?
Play, yeah. I've been working with an Emmy Award-winning editor out of Hollywood. He wanted to turn my book into a play, so we've got the play done, and we're just looking for a place to put it on. So
Good deal.
Maybe someday you can come see the play.
I sure hope so. Okay, you've been listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain, Bella Vista. This is Jim Dowling. I've been interviewing Michael Schlosser about his book, Stalag Vietnam, and we're going to have to wrap it up. So good evening, and thanks for listening.